This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Als Gründerinnen und Gründer willst du vor allem eins, schnell vorankommen. Egal ob beim Product Market Fit, deinem nächsten Schritt oder deinem ersten großen Enterprise Deal. Doch mit KI, die Entwicklung immer schneller macht, steigen auch die Anforderungen an Sicherheit. Und das früher als je zuvor. Wer Themen wie Security und Compliance richtig angeht, ermöglicht Wachstum. Wer zu lange wartet, bremst es aus. Deshalb setzen viele Startups früh auf Wanta und wachsen sicher weiter. Wanta macht es einfach mit tiefen Integrationen, starker Automatisierung und kontinuierlichem Monitoring, das mithält. Und wenn es ans Audit geht, seien Wochen bereit, nicht erst in Monaten. Jetzt starten auf wanta.com. Als Gründerinnen und Gründer willst du vor allem eins, schnell vorankommen. Egal ob beim Product Market Fit, deinem nächsten Schritt oder deinem ersten großen Enterprise Deal. Doch mit KI, die Entwicklung immer schneller macht, steigen auch die Anforderungen an Sicherheit. Und das früher als je zuvor. Wer Themen wie Security und Compliance richtig angeht, ermöglicht Wachstum. Wer zu lange wartet, bremst es aus. Deshalb setzen viele Startups früh auf Wanta und wachsen sicher weiter. Wanta macht es einfach mit tiefen Integrationen, starker Automatisierung und kontinuierlichem Monitoring, das mithält. Und wenn es ans Audit geht, seien Wochen bereit, nicht erst in Monaten. Jetzt starten auf wanta.com.
Welcome to the briefing room with me, David Aronovich. The idea is you and I enter the room together, charts and maps on the walls, and get the issues of the day explained to us in the clearest terms by people who know what they're talking about. And whether we clarify the question or muddy the water, please let us know what you think by writing a review or rating us on iTunes or your podcast provider. And recent reviewers, Mel Fazza, Plymouth's Finest and Alone at Christmas, have done just that. Join them and I'll read out your handle too. This week we're asking, are Labour's plans for nationalising industries like water and rail feasible? And what would the process be for implementing them? And if you enjoy this podcast, you might want to download other editions of The Briefing Room. In recent podcasts we've covered the process of organising referendums, Britain's housing crisis and the economy in Greece. Some listeners may remember this.
Governments aren't good at running business. They're not businessmen. It's not for them to run these businesses, and therefore I think it's far better for them to be privatised. Those that have been privatised have been far more successful. They've done extremely well, done very well for their employees, and many of them taken on more jobs.
30 years on, though, someone's planning a reversal.
We're going to extend economic democracy even further in this country. How? By bringing water, energy, Royal Mail, rail back into public ownership again.
Shadow Chancellor John McDonnell there speaking at Labour's conference in Liverpool this week and setting out plans to nationalise a large range of industries that previous governments had sold off. But how easy is this to do? And what might be the consequences? Join me in the briefing room and all will be revealed. For years, if you were a Labour politician wanting to appear in tune with the times, you might have felt that talk of returning business to state ownership could spell electoral disaster. But today, insofar as we can tell, what's the public mood on this? I'm joined first in the briefing room by Chris Curtis, senior political researcher for the polling organisation YouGov. Chris Curtis, what do the polls tell us about the popularity of the idea of nationalisation amongst British voters?
It depends on the context and it depends on which industry we're looking into. But generally speaking, the sort of industries that, for example, the Labour Party is currently talking about nationalising, whether that be the Royal Mail, the railways or the water companies, they're generally perceived as being reasonably popular to renationalise and sectors that the public do think should be run within the public sector.
What kind of figures are we talking about?
So, again, it varies. Royal Mail, railways, water companies, you're talking more like 6 in 10. If you look at the energy companies, which is slightly more controversial, you drop down to just over 50%. 53% would support keeping them within the public sector, or moving them to the public sector.
And when was this polling done?
This polling done was done in the context of the last general election, when these kind of policies were being put into the Labour manifesto. And it was a big debate in the country about whether these policies were going to cut through or be popular amongst the general public.
How many people are don't knows? Do you get a large proportion of don't knows in these answers, or is it relatively low?
There's a proportion of don't knows, as there always is. It's usually for a question like this, it's about 1 in 5 people say they don't know or undecided.
So as far as we can tell from the polls then, the summary of this is for most of these industries that Labour's talking about, and for some of them in a very big way, the polls suggest that the public are in favour of nationalisation. Now, is there any difference between different groups of voters, demographically, age, location?
Actually, I think what's most interesting about the polling on nationalisation isn't necessarily where there is a difference, but where there isn't one. What we've seen inside a lot of the political research that we're doing at the moment is a massive age divide appearing across almost anything we ask about, where older people are more likely to take the right-wing position and younger people are more likely to say what's typically defined as the left-wing position, so whether that's on Brexit or immigration or climate change. When we look at the last election result, Labour did spectacularly well amongst people under the age of 40, and the Conservatives did spectacularly well amongst people over the age of 40. However, on nationalisation, we're not seeing that divide. If anything, a lot of older voters actually seem to be slightly more in favour of nationalisation than younger voters, which opens up an interesting opportunity for the Labour Party to win back voters who have moved away from them over the past few years.
Now, if we look at what I think you pollsters call salience, how many people would volunteer that this was a big issue for them and loomed large for them, is there any way of judging the salience of nationalisation?
A lot of the research we've done puts it in the sort of second tier issue. At the moment, it is not competing with Brexit, and it has never really competed with the NHS in terms of top issue. But there are also issues that are slightly further down that list that are still important and still matter, and we generally put nationalisation into that camp.
Chris Curtis. So on the surface, at any rate, voters are receptive to the idea of renationalisation. Now, let's get on to the doing. How can such a radical change be accomplished? With me now is Dieter Helm, Professor of Energy Policy and a Fellow in Economics at the University of Oxford. Dieter Helm, John McDonnell has mentioned nationalising water, rail, Royal Mail and energy. How would you set about nationalising those industries?
It's basically pretty straightforward. I mean, the power of the state is substantive. The government could buy the companies and effectively swap the debt for government bonds and indeed compensate the owners with more government bonds. That's essentially what happened in the 1940s when all these things were nationalised. And it's not technically very difficult at all. There's a problem about agreeing about how much, but even in that territory, actually, the grounds for disagreement are quite limited.
How do you set about agreeing what an industry and a company in an industry is worth in order to effectively buy it out?
In the case of these utilities, there is something called the regulatory asset base, and that's the agreed stake of the investors in the company to support what's been put in, what's been built since privatisation. So it would be extraordinary if that regulatory asset base was not honoured. So the question is really what premium you should have on top. What extra should be given for the kind of risk that the investors are taking? And of course, nationalisation is one of those risks, and to incentivise them to outperform. And roughly regulatory asset base plus 10% is a reasonable number to go to. There's no exact right answer to this, and it clearly isn't whatever the share price happened to be a year, 2 or 3 years ago.
How much would it cost to renationalise an industry? Let's take the water industry.
There have been suggestions that it should be the regulatory asset base plus a premium of extraordinary premium of 30%. And some estimates have suggested that that equals 90 billion. Now, I think the 30% is pretty close to absurd. So one's talking about 50, 60 billion in the case of the water industry. But remember, In exchange for that money, the government gets the assets and it gets the revenue flows from the customer's bills. So this is really like, you take out a mortgage and, of course, you've got a liability called your mortgage on your house, but you've got the house. And that's the crucial thing here. The government is acquiring assets for companies where customers pay bills and provide the revenues.
If you were to do this, I mean, John McDonnell's named five industries. How quickly do you think that you could raise the money in order to nationalise all those industries?
We've done this before. So in the much more difficult economic circumstances immediately after the Second World War, within the space of 5 years, almost all the great nationalisations were done. And that was a time when, you know, all the bomb damage was there, the destruction of the war, government debt was already more than twice what it is today, and economic circumstances were pretty dire. And so if you're talking about the amount of money required, I don't see that as an obstacle. Governments have enormous powers to go into the bond markets and borrow. The problem comes if a Labour government comes into power and there's a financial crisis at the same time. And then, you know, all bets are off because it might be every penny is needed to maintain the economy and keep the broad activities of government on course. And in such circumstances, you might not want to rush the markets and borrow a lot more.
In his speech, John McDonnell talked about putting these industries back in the hands of local councils, workers and customers. Does that give a clue as to how he sees these industries being run, or is that essentially, as you see it, rhetorical?
I think this is both a sort of understandable aspiration and a complete muddle. You know, first of all, we don't have local authorities and local government and city government which overlaps with the domains of these companies. Take the Thames. I mean, it's not just London, it's Oxford, it's all the upper river areas too. Which local authority? And remember that unlike in Europe, where local government has considerable powers and indeed financial muscle, we have really stripped back local government to a minimum. So there's a real serious question of trying to work out who overlaps with whom and who has the power, resources and money to do this. So I think the local bit is perhaps a nice aspiration, but it's not thought through. It has to map onto the catchments because the catchments are what define the boundaries of these companies.
If a government, let's say, has aspiration towards greater workers' control, it can't necessarily implement it in the private sector, but of course it could implement it in industries that the government actually owns. What difference would that make?
Labour is actually proposing to do this to the entire private sector for any company over 250 employees. So it's perfectly possible for a government to legislate to put workers on the boards of private companies. It doesn't have to nationalise the water industry to make that happen. The second thing to say is, of course, we have a lot of experience of what happens when governments want workers and trade unions and others to run these businesses. I mean, that was the whole idea behind the nationalisations after the Second World War. Bluntly, it wasn't a great success because it doesn't resolve the fundamental issues, which are how much should be invested versus how low should current bills be, how much should the environment be protected, what liabilities and risks should these companies take on, and how do you get them on a day-to-day basis to do all this efficiently? These are the practical questions that matter. And if you want to have control, and you want to have control in particular ways, i.e. through the workers, through local government and so on, you have to understand or think through how exactly that's going to work. What's it going to be like to sit inside one of these boardrooms and try and decide? Now, in the nationalised industries, in the end what happened was government appointed professional management to run it, a bit like the directors of the companies at the moment, and then put non-executive directors on the board who would represent wider interests, local government, community, unions and so on and so forth. And that sort of worked, and ironically, that's exactly what the water regulator is currently trying to do to the existing water companies.
Can you actually achieve by regulation what some people think you can only achieve by nationalisation?
I think that the issue of regulation is the crux of the matter. It's all about what it is that you want these companies to do to pursue the public interest. And I hold the rather eclectic view that the ownership issue isn't the big question. The big question is the regulatory one. And it's perfectly possible to regulate these companies in a way which makes them pursue the public interest. And if you look at the big issues which are concerning people about the privatised utilities, all of these are ultimately, in my view, down to a failure of regulation to define the public interest and make sure that that public interest is properly inculcated in the boardrooms.
Dieter Helm. The economics and management of renationalisation are complex, potentially expensive, but not impossible. But what has to happen legally for a government to take control of what is currently private enterprise? Here now in the briefing room is Dan Needle, a partner at the multinational law firm Clifford Chance. Dan Needle, what are the main legal challenges to nationalisation?
Nationalisation is one of those things which is a simple sell politically and simple to describe politically, but legally very complex. The first question is, what are you nationalising? Obviously the shares in water companies, electricity companies and so forth, but is it just shares? Well, if you look at the companies, they are remarkably complex beasts. Of course, they have shareholders. They also have banks lending to them. They have bondholders. And the amount of the bank debt and the bonds exceeds the value of the equity by a factor of two or three. They also have swap counterparties. They have pension
liabilities. What?
Swap counterparties. So let's say you want to borrow and you're a large business and you don't want to take the risk of interest rates going up. What you do is you enter into a swap with a bank, under which you agree to pay the bank a set amount of interest every year, so you have complete certainty, and the bank will then pay whatever the market rate of interest is from time to time. When people did that in the 90s, interest rates were quite high. Now interest rates are quite low. So if these businesses, water companies and the like, could go back in time, I'm sure they'd love to just scrap these derivatives, but they can't. They're locked into them. They're a big liability on their balance sheets. Government nationalises them, it inherits that liability, it pops onto the government balance sheet just in the same way gilts are.
So what you're saying is that when you're talking about buying these companies or these industries, who exactly you're buying it from is actually very much more complicated than just buying the shares.
It is. You're buying the shares and then you're making a decision. Do you let banks, bondholders, swap counterparties sit there, or do you take them out? Do you nationalise that too? But if you let them sit there, these people are receiving money now from a nationalised company, but that company is paying them far more than government normally would. Government's debt is cheap for government, debt is expensive for companies, and you're paying at a corporate rate on what's really government debt. So it's a bad bargain for the taxpayer.
What about the investors themselves? Let's say that you're saying, well, we're going to make effectively a compulsory offer for your shares. If Parliament decides to do that, what redress at law do unwilling sellers have?
The Labour Party says that Parliament will set the price, and they point to the nationalisation of Northern Rock, where the Northern Rock shares were acquired for basically nothing, and some shareholders sued, and they lost. But they lost because Northern Rock was bust. These are valuable companies. For a British investor, European investor, they could look to the Human Rights Act. Article 1, Protocol 1, gives you a right against property being taken from you by government. And the courts have held that means you have to receive reasonable compensation. Weirdly, the people with a more robust claim than that, an easier claim than that, are not British pension funds or French pension funds. They're Chinese, Hong Kong and Arab investors because of the investment agreements that over years that the UK has signed with those countries.
Sorry, let me get this absolutely straight. Although we could probably find ways of dealing with British pension funds and so on, we would actually face more of a problem with legal challenges from foreign investors.
Yeah, go back to the 1980s. The British government wanted to encourage British industry to invest in the developing world, but British industry was worried that if it did so, it would be nationalised. So the UK signed what are called bilateral investment treaties with a host of developing countries. And whilst the intention was to protect our guys against nationalisation over there, they worked the other way around too. And so today, we have a large number of investors in British infrastructure coming from places like Hong Kong, China, India, Singapore, with these treaties. And these are treaties that the British Parliament cannot override.
Let's suppose the new British government says that it wants to do this, passes the necessary legislation through Parliament, and then one of these investors says, no, we don't want to do this.
They begin proceedings under the bilateral investment treaty. So it's a Chinese investor, the UK-China BIT. Those proceedings are not brought in a British court. They're brought in an international arbitration tribunal. And that means that there is no act of parliament that can override that or change the result. If they've been nationalised for less than market value, they would have an excellent claim for prompt compensation at market value.
And who would be setting the market value?
There's the question. It's interesting to look back to the 70s, which is the last time we had a nationalisation of profitable businesses. There it was a nationalisation of aerospace and docks. And how it worked is the Parliament looked at the average market price in the 6 months prior to the first 1974 election. And that's how they set market value. For private companies, in a rather 1970s way, they had beer and sandwiches at number 10 and negotiated what the market price would be. And if they weren't able to reach agreement, it went to a binding UK tribunal that was set up. But if the British government tries to be clever and tries to nationalise at less than market value, you could be sure there will be challenges all across the world, and it could end up a very expensive proposition for the government.
Dan Needle. The range of activities undertaken by the businesses that Labour wants the state to own is pretty vast. So let's narrow things down and take a closer look at one of the most important, the water industry. Currently, ownership of the UK's water industry varies considerably across the regions, with only England having completely sold off its supplies to private investors. Meanwhile, in Wales, water is supplied by a single not-for-profit company, Welsh Water, whilst Northern Ireland and Scotland both have national public suppliers. Joining me now are Dr. Sarah Hendry, Senior Lecturer in Law at the University of Dundee and a specialist in water and environmental law, and the journalist Karma Loveday, who has been writing about the water business for 20 years and is also editor of The Water Report. Karma Loveday, why do you think John McDonnell has targeted water companies for the first wave of his nationalisation plan?
I think the underlying principle is an ideological one. I think that's clear from the Labour Party's wider economic policy. I think it is an interesting choice to choose water because I think the more natural, obvious choice would have been rail, given the extent of problems that that sector has seen in recent times. So I think the Labour Party is trying to tap in to the fact that people have an emotional connection with water. It's an absolutely fundamental service that underpins life and health and well-being. And I think, therefore, it's perhaps a softer target for people that are not naturally inclined to support nationalisation as a principle.
Sarah Hendry, we've talked essentially about water being a natural monopoly.
Yep.
How do you go about organising the principles of a business in a natural monopoly?
Well, I think we can look at what the situation is here in Scotland. What happened in England and Wales in 1989 was very unusual globally. Most countries, even although they've maybe introduced some private sector participation, have never divested the asset base for water services. So it's a quintessential natural monopoly. And what we did here in Scotland when we moved from municipal supply, instead of divesting the assets, we had, first of all, regional water authorities and then brought them together into a national public corporation. And I think that we've demonstrated in Scotland since 2002 that the private sector is not necessarily more efficient than the public. And I would even go further now and say that in Scotland we've taken out that tension between the customer interests, the environmental interests, the public policy goals, and those very reasonable interests of shareholders and boards to make a profit. And we just don't have that. And I think that's actually a benefit.
That's quite an interesting observation, Karma Loveday, which is, it's not obvious, is it, how you reconcile the different interests of the consumers, the investors, environmental interests and so on. What you'd normally expect is that they'd all get cross with each other.
I would agree with everything Sarah said there, actually. The Scottish water example is very successful in public ownership. There have been marked improvements in service and efficiency and so on. And I think having investors in the mix in England does introduce a different and more complex dynamic. But equally, I don't think it's black and white. I don't think just because it's public ownership is successful in one context, we can automatically assume that it would be the right choice for other contexts. And there are places around the world where publicly owned utilities are in a far less positive place than Scottish Water.
What challenges do you think, Sarah, a newly nationalised water industry across the whole of the UK would face?
I think in developed countries like this, where there's a very strong regulatory model and a very coherent public policy, if you weren't going to move to a public corporation, water should be a safe bet for investors. It should be something where a bond issue, for example, should be very attractive. I don't think there will be a UK-wide system. So I think that John McDonnell is talking specifically about England. And we can also think about what happened in Wales, where Welsh Water was essentially bought out of the private sector. And although it's run as a corporate body, it's a company limited by guarantee that doesn't have that profit incentive. I think that John McConnell talked about regional water authorities. And obviously, we don't have any real detail on the corporate form, if you like, but my understanding is that he would anticipate them having a board that would bring together customers, very important, local authorities from different tiers, perhaps, maybe some environmental interest groups, and of course the technical experts, the engineers who actually make the system work. And there would be a need on those boards to have people with business expertise. Scottish Water is certainly run as a business, so that would be vital as well.
Is there anything that you can do through nationalisation, Carmel Loveday, that you couldn't do through regulation?
I think we need to look at the evidence. I mean, from my point of view, it's putting the cart before the horse to assume that the problems can be solved by nationalising the industry. It's healthy to question the model, but to assume that public ownership, which I believe is an ideological driven conclusion, is the right answer is quite risky.
Sarah Hendry, what's your view?
The critical thing is the regulation. And I think that the regulatory structure in both Scotland and England and Wales is quite robust. But I do still think that there's a tension between the legitimate aspirations of the board of a private company and the legitimate aspirations of policymakers and consumers. So I think it just removes an area of tension. I think the regulatory job in England is more challenging because of the scale, and there are numerous operators and they all have slightly different business models and geographical contexts and economic contexts. And I don't think that regulatory job is made easier by having private firms. And I think our experience here has been that once you get the provider on board, if the provider's interest is also in delivering the best possible service at the lowest reasonable cost, then that's easier rather than if there's this additional requirement to make a profit, to pay dividends and so forth.
Just one final question to both of you. As far as you can tell, let's suppose that we were able to discern a nationalisation project for England. Would you expect, either of you, bills to go up or down, or do you think they'd be unaffected? Karma.
Well, there is, in my view, no clarity at all on that. I mean, if you look at the status quo or some kind of tweaked version of it, there is clarity about the trajectory for bills. So the water companies have five-year planning cycles, and they very recently, a few weeks ago, published their plans for 2020 to 2025. Those plans suggest that in real terms, bills would go down by an average of 4% and investment would go up by 13% to 50 billion. So we've got absolute clarity on that. We don't have any clarity about how pricing would look under a nationalised model. But one final point I would like to raise, which I think is often lost in these discussions, is about future investment levels. So under a nationalised framework, we don't have any clarity about future investment levels. It depends on the model that's put in place. So if, for example, the revenue from bills was ring-fenced for reinvestment in water, I can see that there would be a revenue stream for future investment going forwards. If, for example, that bill revenue is subsumed into wider public sector budgets, as it is in some places, and water has to compete with the likes of schools and hospitals for investment, I think we can all see in a constrained budget environment that schools and hospitals would win hands down.
Sarah Hendry.
I would very much hope that there would be no intention to return to anything like a municipal system where water is just one of a set of services that are financed together and would have to compete with schools or hospitals. It's hard to see exactly how the detail will pan out, but assuming that there was still a regulatory body whose role is to determine both prices and investment in the context of companies' five-year business plans or water authorities' five-year business plans, it's exactly what we do with Scottish Water here, then I would hope that that investment for the future would absolutely be secured.
Sarah Hendry there, and Karma Loveday. And what's my take on this? That we'll be hearing a lot more on this issue, and our job is to keep our eyes on the facts. My thanks to Dan Needle, Dieter Helm, Sarah Hendry, Karma Loveday, and Chris Curtis. And we'll be back next week. The Briefing Room was presented by me, David Aronovich. The producers were Neil Koenig, Siobhan O'Connell and Tom Hill. And please let us know what you think about this programme or indeed the entire series. You can do that by writing a review or rating us on iTunes or your podcast provider. We really do appreciate hearing from you.
Ich bin Charissa und meine Empfehlung an alle Entrepreneure, startet mit Shopify erfolgreich durch. Ich verwende Shopify schon seit dem ersten Tag und die Plattform macht mir nie Probleme. Ich habe viele Probleme, aber die Plattform ist nie eins davon. Ich habe das Gefühl, dass Shopify ihre Plattform kontinuierlich optimiert. Alles ist super einfach, integrier und verlinkbar. Und die Zeit und das Geld, das ich dadurch spare, kann ich anderweitig investieren. Vor allem in Wachstum.
Jetzt kostenlos testen auf shopify.de.